Hey, welcome back to the Old Gravy Podcast. Today's show, you're going to have Old Gravy all by himself, but I want you to take come on this ride for me. I want to talk about, we're going to jump right in. I want to talk about our institutions, not all of them. Today, I'm going to focus on our judicial system and what's been going on a long time in the judicial system, which is not good for the country. And, you know, I'm sure the judicial system's had problems over the decades, but if you don't address them and kind of take a deeper look at what's going on, yeah, there's a lot of forces out there that are going to mislead you. So believe it or not, I'm going to take you back to 2012 to a national story. It was the Trayvon Martin case, and it was about a young black guy, young black man, young black kid. He was only 17 years old. He was killed by an armed community. He was killed by a community watch volunteer, but there's a little bit more to that. That's kind of what the media wanted to label it as. But we're going to dig in a minute. But I'm going to tell you why I'm going back to the Trayvon Martin case back in 2012, and then we're going to wind our way right up into 2024 with this. But let me give you a little background how this particular case has interested me. So there's a John McWhorter. He's a Columbia professor. And then there's a Glenn Lowry, who's at Brown University. These are both professors, and they have a YouTube show called The Black Guys. And they introduced me to a documentarian named Joel Gilbert. And he did a 2000 documentary called The Trayvon Hoax. And I was like, this is interesting. I got two black professors talking about this on their show. And then they say it's very believable. They believed what Joel Gilbert put together. And I said, I got to take a look at this. So I watched this documentary. It's called The Trayvon Martin Hoax. It came out in 2019. So this incident happened in 2012, 2019. This movie comes out that I watch, and I find it fascinating. The guy who did it, his name is Gilbert. He's a musician and a filmmaker. He's done filmmaking with a lot of different musicians. But Wikipedia calls him a conspiracy theorist. I think he's a quirky guy. There's no doubt about that. But, he comes up with a really fascinating investigation of the Trayvon Martin case. Back in 2012. So why am I relitigating this case? One, it's interesting. And two, it kind of shows collusion between elites in society. And race is not a factor here. Everyone's participating in this collusion as I see it. And it's very corruptive. And it focuses around the Trayvon Martin case. And you'll see how it kind of winds its way into the George Floyd case in 2020. And what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to tie this all together for you. So go along for this ride, because I think you're going to find it interesting. One of the people we're going to be talking about is Benjamin Crump. He's a famous civil rights attorney, and he becomes the family attorney for Trayvon Martin's family. And believe it or not, his mother, Sabrina Fulton, allegedly... what they do, I found unbelievable if it's true. I can't say if it's 100%. Did they do it? They didn't do it. But I'm going to tell you what I've learned from the document, from watching the film, and also from reading some other things about the case. So let's get into the case, and I'm going to refresh your memory. It was a big case. It was down in Sanford, Florida, which is outside Orlando. So you have this town watch and this townhouse community, but it's no more than a bunch of the people in the neighborhood getting together with the local law enforcement, and they're concerned about break-ins of their cars. There was a home invasion. So the people in this community are a little bit, they're upset, they're nervous. Crime is rising in 2012, and they call the community together, and they kind of give them tips on what they need to do if they see something going on. So let's get to George Zimmerman. So George Zimmerman is a guy that lives in this community. He's married. He's an insurance underwriter. And he's going out one night on a rainy night to Target. And he notices He notices somebody with a hoodie on between buildings, but it's rainy, it's dark, and the person seems to be going nowhere. So Zimmerman thinks he looks suspicious, and he kind of thinks he's like loitering between houses. So what he does is he calls the police, because that's what that meeting they had in the community, you know, call the police if you see anything. Call. So he calls the dispatcher. And he talks to him. He says, I'm seeing a suspicious person. He was loitering. And the dispatcher says to him, well, do you still see him? And he goes, no. He goes, are you following him? And he goes, yes. But at this point, he's actually stopped his car and he's actually lost track where this Trayvon Martin is, this 17-year-old kid. So at one point, the dispatcher does say to him, don't follow him. We don't need you to do that. Do you have any idea what direction he went? And he's like, yeah, well, he was headed this way, I think. So Zimmerman, after he gets off the phone with the 911, he starts thinking, well, if the cops show up, let me go out and look and if I can see where this person might be moving towards. So he gets out of his car. He walks up between a few houses. He doesn't see Trayvon at this point. So he starts walking back to his car. As he's on his way back to his car, he hears someone says, hey, do you have a problem? As soon as he turns around, he says, no, I don't have a problem. And boom, he's punched in the face. And he has a broken nose, and that will be medical evidence as we go through this case with Zimmerman and Trayvon. So I'm going to go through the fight real quick. Zimmerman's punched in the face. He's lying on the ground. His nose is broken and bleeding. He's kind of choking on his blood. And at the same time, after the punches are being thrown, Trayvon has grabbed him by his neck and is kind of pounding his head back into the cement. At one point, a woman calls 911. You can hear screaming. And that screaming is actually Zimmerman screaming for help. And you can hear it because the woman has her windows open and she calls 911 saying there's a fight outside my condo. So at that moment, a witness stops out of their house and they testify in court that Zimmerman's getting his ass beat. And the neighbor who sees it yells out to Trayvon or the two guys fighting, hey, stop or I'm going to call the police. But he will be a witness that Trayvon is on top of Zimmerman, giving him the ground and pound. At that point, when he runs back into this house to call the police, Zimmerman is trying to get off the cement because that's where his head's getting pounded into, and he tries to get back to the grass. At that point, his shirt comes up. He has a license to carry a firearm. At that point, he says that Trayvon reaches for his gun. No one will know if that's true because there's no eyewitnesses to that, and Trayvon's not here to say anything, and that was Zimmerman's testimony. Long story short, he pulls that firearm and in defense, he shoots Trayvon and he kills him. So that's what we have. Now, this testimony, you could do your own research on it. The media narrative in the beginning, before we get through all the trial and the real evidence, but what I told you is basically what the court saw or what the jury saw at the time. But the media, when they first started this story down in Florida, it was that a white Hispanic, which was a new term, Zimmerman was half Hispanic, half white, and the media started, and he identified as an Hispanic man. They started identifying him as a white Hispanic because there definitely seems to be an angle that the media wants to present. And, you know, to Zimmerman's defense, he works with black kids at some youth organization. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to set a narrative here. And I'll really say this, regardless of whatever narrative it was set up from the left or the right, because there are two narratives here, this was an unfortunate night. It brought Zimmerman and Trayvon into each other's universe, and it went bad. Trayvon died. He's a 17-year-old kid. He's dead. But my feeling on it, there's no heroes. And quite frankly, there's no unredeemable villains here either. And as the filmmaker who made the documentary, he says he got to know Trayvon really well. And by watching his documentary, I felt I did too, because Once this went to court, this filmmaker was able to get every text, every phone call, every picture that Trayvon ever sent 9 months before his life, before the end of his life. And in not only do you get to learn about Trayvon through all his correspondence with family and friends, he also, this filmmaker also gets to meet with Zimmerman and walk you through his side of the story. So I thought by watching this documentary, not how I thought, how I felt, is, you know, Trayvon lost his life, horrible, 17 years old, and his life is over. And Zimmerman, in a way, lost his mind. And, you know, it's one of those things. Too bad their worlds collided on that night, because it didn't end well for either one of them. Obviously, it ended really bad for Trayvon. But I do want to say this about Trayvon. By me watching this documentary, I learned more than what my first impression was when this case came back, when this case came out over 10 years ago. I have definitely, because I dug into it, you watch this, you get to see what the kid was saying and what he was doing. One thing I know for sure, his mother, his stepmother, his father had a criminal record, but he was a working man. They loved their kid, and they were really trying to, they were trying to straighten him out. And he had, at this point in his life, he was 17. He did have some issues, and I'm going to list some of those. I'm not saying he was in, he was a gangster in the worst part of town, shooting people and running with the Bloods and the Crips or anything like that. He wasn't. But at 17, he was smoking a lot of weed. He was posing with guns on Twitter. And guns are pretty prominent in Florida. People go to the range a lot. So I don't want to act like that's so unusual that someone's posing with guns. You can see people doing that today. But he was mixing codeine with soda to get high. That might have been the kid thing. A lot of young people were doing that back then. And he was hanging with some bad kids. And the next thing that he got into was street fighting. Watching it on YouTube and participating in it. And he was an athletic kid, and he liked street fighting. And actually, I think it became addictive. And that does become addictive to young guys. It's like getting an adrenaline hit for street fighting, and it built him up a reputation. And I'm not saying he was out doing it every day, but this kid's tough. He's a tough kid, and he is a street fighter. And you can kind of tell he is by what he was able to do to Zimmerman on the ground that day. But what would I say overall about Trayvon at the time? That if it was a plane, that nose of the plane was headed down. It wasn't coming at straight down into the ground, but that nose was headed down for trouble. But I don't know. I don't think he was going to crash and burn. I mean, with a life of trouble. Maybe not, but basically, based on his texts and getting to hear other people talk about him, it did not seem like that was his ultimate destination. So I'll leave you with that. At first, when this case came, when the cops got there, it really looked like a self-defense case. And even Zimmerman took the police out to reenact what happened. He took a voice lie detector test. It's not exactly a polygraph, but he did do a voice test, which came out honest. He kind of walked them through everything. He said he didn't want to shoot him, but he feared for his life. You know, so it was basically a self-defense case. The media started trying to make it out to be a stand your ground case because it was a very controversial new law that had been passed in Florida. But in the end, it didn't apply here, though the media tried to push that in the beginning. So the attorney that represents the family of Trayvon Martin is Benjamin Crum. Now, Benjamin Crum today is a famous civil rights attorney, but this is his first big case. This is his debutante ball. This case will make his career. And he comes out with kind of a narrative that Zimmerman hunted down this kid because he was a white man and he was a young black man, and he was kind of hunted down, followed, and killed by Zimmerman for no real apparent reason. That was the positioning of Crum. But the problem is that the police have audio and eyewitnesses of what actually happened. So Crum's initial statements of what he is projecting that happens is not really holding up that well, because it really does look like a self-defense case. And the fact that you can hear Zimmerman yelling for help on over the 911 call of a woman that lives in the community, never mind the neighbor who witnessed Trayvon on top of him and yelling stop, and goes back into the house, that's an eyewitness right there. So this is really looking like a self-defense. But there's a big change in the case, and this big change in the case is going to feed all that media, all that racial politics. That's all going to come together when this Benjamin Crum comes up with another witness. And I'm going to be back to tell you about that. We got a big break in the case now. So this self-defense case of this 28-year-old George Zimmerman, who has just shot Trayvon Martin, the 17-year-old, who is actually, and I might not have told you, he's in this neighborhood because his dad's girlfriend lives in this neighborhood. So he has a right to be in that neighborhood. I should have told you that a bit earlier. So Trayvon Martin has a right to be in this neighborhood. So this is the big break for Crum. Benjamin Crum comes out and tells the world and the police that he is a phone witness that was talking to Trayvon right at the time of the murder. And the phone records match that up. Crum's not lying. He has a phone record and a conversation. He doesn't have the conversation, but he has a documentation of that conversation with Trayvon. And as Benjamin Crum said, his girlfriend. His girlfriend's name is Diamond Eugene. So he is on the phone. This is legitimate. Crum is not making anything up right here. He's saying that there is a witness that was on the phone right when Trayvon was attacked. So right before the attack, according to Crum, after talking to the girlfriend, is that Trayvon is telling the girlfriend while he's on the phone, this guy is following me, he's right behind me, he's walking up to me. Trayvon was scared, and Zimmerman comes up behind him and says, why are you following me? And Trayvon says to Zimmerman, why are you following me? And Zimmerman says, what are you doing around here? The girlfriend says at that moment, it sounded like the phone fell down and that there was a scuffle and then the call went dead. And that was the testimony. Now, this is big. This is someone that is testifying that it was Trayvon that was scared, not Zimmerman. So, this can all be confirmed. The phone logs at the time of the murder, which the police had set a time for the murder, as they always did, based on the other witnesses in the community. Now Crum starts organizing protests, student walkouts. He starts feeding the media beast that this was not self-defense. This was blatant murder by like an overzealous neighborhood watch guy. That is the narrative, and that's what Crum starts pushing out. Now, this witness, Diamond Eugene, is hearing all about this news. And I'm going to kind of circle back to Diamond Eugene. I kind of want to give you a feel for what's going on in the media at this point. Like, first of all, as soon as this comes out that Crum has this witness that kind of turns this away from a self-defense and a hunting of this poor kid, I don't want to say he's the first guy to jump in, but one of the guys to jump in is Obama. And he says, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon, or Trayvon could be my son. I don't know the exact quote, but you could look it up. But we all know that's not true. And that's all throwing fuel on the fire. Because Obama's kids wouldn't have been, Trayvon lived a working class, middle class life, but is with parents that cared about him. But the Obama's kids were privileged. The parents, Obama and his wife, Michelle, are sophisticated Ivy Leaguers. Their kids are in private schools. They have a good generational upbringing. They're upper class, powerful elites. Obama's kid would not just be like Trayvon. That is setting more of a narrative. And that's the first thing he comes out with. And it's kind of confirming the fake narrative that Crum is putting out there. Because the eyewitnesses didn't see this and that this kid was stalked and killed. But that's the beginning of it. And Obama would do that in the Michael Brown case, too, with the hands up with Michael Brown. He said, you know, Michael Brown's death awakened our nation once again to the reality that black people have long understood why too many young men of color feel targeted by law enforcement. And we all know that the Michael Brown case, we're not going to relitigate that, but that case, even by Obama's own Department of Justice, proved Michael Brown attacked the cop, ran away, then ran back toward the cop, and that's why he got shot, and there was no hands up or anything like that. But two times, Obama was setting a fake narrative. That's my belief. And if you look at what happened in these cases, that's obvious. What he should have done is said nothing. Just say, this is a tragedy. We need to find justice. That's the best thing any politician could do. Then this story started going like wildfire. This Benjamin Crump, he's good. He's talented. Bobby Rush on Congress, a congressman, former Black Panther. He wore a hoodie and made all the national news. He wore the hoodie in the well of the Congress saying, like, you know, young men are being hunted just for wearing a hoodie, young black men specifically. LeBron James, of course, he jumps into this. I mean, you got Sharpton came down there, you know, when we know his history with Tawana Brawley. Even Gilliam, a guy who ran against DeSantis in 2018, 6 years after the case, was kind of promoting his campaign about what happened to Trayvon and how he was going to seek this racial justice for the people of Florida. This was hardcore stuff, this story, getting this narrative out. But here's the truth. This eyewitness, which is a big eyewitness, the girl that's on the phone that attorney Benjamin Crump has found, we'll never know what Diamond Eugene heard on the phone that night. We will never know because she will never testify on the record. She will never make a public statement, and she's never come forward to make a statement. So I know you're sitting there. Well, what do you mean she doesn't come forward? Okay, this is what happens. Diamond Eugene ignored all the calls from Crump. He was able to find that they spoke on the phone records, but she doesn't want anything to do with this case. Diamond Eugene is called by Trayvon's family. She's called by Crump. She's called by Trayvon's personal friends, guys that live in the neighborhood. They stalk this girl to say, listen, you got to come forward. And what she does is turn off of the phone. So we have no idea what she actually heard on that night on the phone, because she will never go to court. Now, I'm alleging this. Some people say this is not true. But this is my belief based on reading and looking into this guy's documentary. And like I said before, listening to the two guys from the Ivy Leagues, African-American professors, they were like, this information is pretty powerful that this Gilbert guy went out and made into a documentary. Anyway, why isn't this girl participating? Why is she not working with Crum? This is a huge case. Why isn't she helping? Trayvon has been shot and killed. And if she knows something, the court needs to know, the world needs to know, because this is creating a lot of tension in the country. The reason she doesn't want anyone to know is her real boyfriend didn't know she was flirting and cheating with Trayvon. There's hours of calls and texts. I'm not making this up out of my head. You can see her conversing with both her boyfriend and both Trayvon. And Gilbert highlights that in the film. Like, you can see and read the text for yourself. And interesting about Diamond Eugene's boyfriend, he's this real hardworking kid with two jobs. He's going to school and he's going to church. And she's upset that he's not showing her enough attention. And you can kind of see how the relationship with him and Diamond Eugene, she starts talking to Trayvon, and they talk a lot. They talk a ton, hours and hundreds of texts. So Diamond wants nothing to do with this case because she doesn't want to be exposed in front of the boyfriend, but she probably doesn't want to get in the middle of it because she felt she probably wasn't really Trayvon's boyfriend. And there is a media frenzy out there. Half the country is calling Trayvon a gangster, and the other half of the country is calling him an innocent kid that was slaughtered by a guy who stalked him and shot him for no apparent reason except for wearing a hoodie walking through the neighborhood. So Diamond's under immense pressure. She ends up turning off her phone. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to get into the court case. Okay, we're back. Let me refresh where we just were. So basically, Trayvon Martin, his murder, there was a witness on the phone compared to the other witnesses that I talked about. But that real witness, her real name is, her nickname is Diamond Eugene, but her real name is Brittany Diamond Eugene. And this clever Gilbert is the one that was able to locate her, find her. He doesn't reveal himself to her either, and I'll get to more to that later. But her real name, everyone should know, is Brittany Diamond Eugene. And once again, this is alleged. If you went up to that girl today and saw her, she might say, I had nothing to do with it. I don't know what you're talking about. But there's a lot of phone records that point back to her. So now Crump is gone. Benjamin Crump, the attorney, has now gone public about this witness. And the narrative is, the girlfriend on the phone said Trayvon's scared, and he's actually trying, this is what they broadcasted. He was trying to get away, and this is this narrative that he was scared and trying to get away from George Zimmerman, this is now the most powerful people in the country are talking about it. But Crump's in a jam. They have to deliver this witness to secure, a murder conviction, because they are putting Zimmerman on trial. They have the prosecutor, the DA and the prosecutor decide to put him on trial. And I think the reason they decide to put him on trial is because Crump has come up with this phone call. The only problem is he doesn't have a witness. And that is a big, big problem. So what he'll do, and my understanding is that Trayvon's mother works with Crum to find another witness for them, a fake witness, an imposter witness. And her name is Rachel Juntel. And she will be the girl that will take the stand in the Zimmerman murder trial against Trayvon Martin. But there's some big issues with Rachel Juntel. First of all, I believe she was not the girl on the phone. And that it's pretty obvious when you watch the documentary. So let me give you a little background on Rachel Juntel. She is a 18-year-old girl in ninth grade. She reads at a fourth grade level. She's a very big girl. She weighs about 258 pounds. And that's probably 100 pounds more than Trayvon. You're probably saying, why am I describing this girl in such detail? Because it only helps to confirm that this would not be Trayvon's girlfriend. With all the phone communications that this guy, Gilbert, the filmmaker, has gotten, you learn about Trayvon months before his death. And most of he's got girlfriends online who he meets. There's about four of them. And you can see their pictures. And these are attractive young women. They're normal high school girls. They're all cute. They're all height and weight proportionate. One's a preacher's daughter. It's obvious that Trayvon is not dating Rachel Juntel. That's my opinion. And if you watch her in the case, and you'd be surprised seeing her, that Trayvon, who's this athletic, really good-looking boy, that he was dating her. And that's how I see it. And the real Diamond, who was on the phone that night, is very attractive. And you will see her in the film. Gilbert is able to, and we're going to get into how he's able to meet with her. But here's the bottom line. Trayvon was dating really hot girls, smart girls, fun girls. He wasn't going after Rachel Juntel. And I'm sure that, you know, the poor kid, you know, if he was looking down from the heavens, he'd be like, oh, my God, you know, what are they doing to my reputation? And I don't say that. I don't mean to be mean about that or vicious about that to Rachel Gentella at all, but this was really a stretch. I mean, this is a girl with learning disabilities, and she doesn't belong there. And they're going to put this girl under a lot of pressure. You can actually see in Florida, they film the depositions before the trial, and you can see Rachel Gentell, like, not understanding really some of the questions being asked, and sometimes getting upset and putting her heads in their hands. And she kind of mumbles a lot, like, I shouldn't be here, or that's not true. But it's hard to make out. But you can tell this is a girl that's under stress. And any other kid would have been under stress, too, to be a witness in the depositions and the trial that were coming up. But this was more like she didn't really have the capacity to really understand what they were making her do. And it's very uncomfortable, and you can see it in the documentary. They actually ask her, you know, her name's Rachel Gentell, about her nickname, why she had it. And she said, well, a lot of girls have, you know, other nicknames online and stuff. And that was kind of her fake name. And they ask her about the name, and she can't even pronounce it. So that's a real train wreck. And they even have video of the family's lawyer working with her, because I guess that's evidence that has to be turned over. And you can see it's coaching too. Well, I see it's coaching. He's leading the witness. Basically, he would coach her this way. He would say, this is what happened, and then kind of have her say yes, and then have her repeat it back to him. And she'd screw it up over and over again. So that really tells you, like, wow, something is up with this witness. And here's another opinion of mine is, and I don't want it to make it, like, this is cutting across all races. The district attorney down in Sanford is a Syrian woman. The prosecutor is Cuban. I think they knew this was a bogus witness. And I'm surprised they didn't go out and find the new witness, to find the real witness. They could have just did what Gilbert did in his documentary, go find the real witness. But they didn't. And I start to wonder, are they just looking for a scalp? This is a big racial trial. This could make their careers. Are they just looking for a scalp so they can put it on their resume? To me, either they were terrible at their jobs, or they were colluding. And that's what frustrates me about a lot of our institutions. Since I don't believe in conspiracies, I believe there is I call it collusion. And there seems to be a lot of it. So there was also a fake letter that was supposedly written by Diamond Eugene to Trayvon's mother, telling her how awful she felt and what she heard that night. But that letter was never revealed, so the defense couldn't see it right. They only got to see it right before the trial. But meanwhile, Trayvon's mother admitted that she had gotten it months earlier. And the truth is, Rachel Gentell, the imposter witness, she couldn't write a letter like that. Then they tried to say, well, she dictated it to someone, but she at least signed it. But in the documentary, Gilbert will prove that's wrong, because the way he meets the real Diamond is she owns a boutique. She's a Florida State graduate. She owns this boutique. He buys 10 expensive dresses, says he wants to pay her cash, meets her in a hotel, films it all. He gets her to sign notes to the women he's going to give the dress to. He makes her use words that she used in the supposed letter she wrote. And then they bring it to a writing expert who says, well, that they don't match up. So it looks like the letter that they had in court, that was also a fake. But I just want to say, this is how much work this Gilbert guy is doing. He's the only guy that actually ever found the real witness, Diamond. So you got to give the guy credit. So I'm going to take, in the end, what you need to know is the jury saw through this, but I never heard them comment on it about the fake witness. But bringing in a fake witness, if an officer of the court does that, allegedly, you know, that's a big problem. So let's talk about, when we get back from the break, I want to talk about who is Benjamin Crump, because he's a big deal right now. And when we get back, I'm going to tell you about him. Okay, welcome back to the Old Gravy Podcast. I just left you off with Zimmerman, George Zimmerman, getting exonerated for shooting Trayvon Martin. But Benjamin Crump, we talk about allegedly him using a fake witness in this trial. Unbelievable. But who, and you know, like I said before, an officer of the court, a civil rights lawyer, using a fake witness, I find that amazing. You're not really looking for justice when you're doing that. And if someone does it, I'm surprised no one's looked into it to hold someone accountable for it, even though it's so many years have passed. But maybe we're missing something. Maybe there's something I don't know. I'm going off a documentary and what two professors told me to watch. But I found it intriguing. And if you get a chance, it's called the Trayvon Martin Hoax. You should go watch it on YouTube. Okay. So after the Trayvon Martin case, this led to the BLM movement. It led to Michael Brown's hands up, which we know wasn't true. Even Obama's Department of Justice knows that. It actually led to the Ferguson effect, where cops don't leave their car because, you know, they don't want to get involved. And we're still dealing with that today. And that is going on. And that could be a whole other show just about the Ferguson effect. Now, Trayvon's mom, Sabrina Fulton, she ran for political office. And today, I believe she's a Democratic activist. And I guess she's making a living that way. I don't know. But I will say this. I give her a pass on the fake witness. You know, her 17-year-old kid was killed. And I'll tell you why I give her a pass. She wasn't looking for justice in that trial. She wanted revenge. And she lost her kid. And if you lose your kid in that way, you're going to want revenge. And I'm only speculating on her thinking. My speculation is that even if Trayvon attacked Zimmerman, broke his nose, and was banging his head off the pavement, she probably thought he's a 28-year-old man. Why didn't he just fight? Why didn't he just fight? Why did he have to draw a weapon and shoot her son? And I get that. I kind of give her a pass. She lost the kid. She's going to do anything to get even with the guy that drew the weapon and shot him. A lot of people will disagree with that. But listen, that's human beings. You lose your kid. You don't care, you know, that he was nervous or scared or whatever. So that's my pass on Trayvon Martin's mother. Now, Benjamin Crump, let's get back to him. Who is he today? So after he does the Trayvon Martin case, and they only won like $1 million against the condo complex from the homeowners policies or whatever. And I don't even, it was probably a settlement out of course. But who is Benjamin Crump? He's done 40 big, very well-known cases across the country. Most of them have to do with police, race, brutality. Some of them I'll give you, obviously we have Trayvon Martin. We have the Michael Brown case. He got $1.5 million for Michael Brown's family. I don't know how he got that, but he got $1.5 million. Breonna Taylor, that was a case a couple of years ago down in Louisville. I won't go into that case, but a big nationwide case. The George Floyd case, which we will get into, Crump got a settlement for $27 million before the criminal trial settled or started. He got $27 million for the family. You can only imagine what that says to a jury. Wow, the cops screwed up so bad, the city of Minneapolis already settled the case. But we're going to talk about that later. He sued the Northwestern University for the football team. There was some racist coach there. He's made Tupac documentaries. He had a reality TV show, You're the Jury. He had $500 million that he sued for Flint, Michigan, for the children of Flint, Michigan. A lot of minority children got screwed with that bad water. He got about $500 million there. My point is, Crump now is a billion-dollar brand. He is a billion-dollar brand. And I'll give you a little background on him. Crump is 54 years old. He's from North Carolina. He had nine siblings. He's raised by his grandmother. Mother worked in a Converse factory. At night, she cleaned a motel. And the best thing his mother ever did is she sent him down to her ex-husband, not his father, not Crump's father, who was a math teacher in Florida. And Crump feels that's the guy who raised him. That was his father. And, I got to say it. This guy is a self-made man. There's no doubt about it. If Walter Isaacson has done books on Jobs, and he's doing Elon Musk, and he did Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Crump, the attorney, is not sitting in a law office scouring over legal briefs. He's got a whole army of vendors and lawyers, legal vendors, and surrogates doing a lot of this work because he's got a huge caseload. They're all high-profile cases. This guy is a billion-dollar industry, and there's a lot of people clinging on to that. The other group that I think is kind of clinging and working with him that I believe is the Democratic Party and their politics. This guy is good at writing narratives for them, and these narratives are popping up. They've been popping up every day over the past few years, and I think Crump is a good source of those. And as I close this out about Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman and the fake witness, our next trip on the podcast is going to be with Benjamin Crump again. And we're going to get into the George Floyd case, because guess who's representing the family in that case? Benjamin Crump. So listen in for the next episode.